Colleagues, if we could take our seats, please. We'll begin. Good afternoon and welcome to the July 8th edition of the Joint Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. Today we are going to have an informational meeting on the wild fish policy. We have here today Steve Smith from the National Marine Fisheries Service, and then Mr. Mark Kelly will make the presentation on UMPQA Land Exchange Project. Mr. Smith, welcome. Good afternoon. Did you know you're comfortable, Chris? It's the Salmon Committee Rosarch test.
That's the feeding test. Well, thank you very much for having me. My name is Steve Smith. I'm chief of the Hatcheries and Inland Fisheries Branch for National Marine Fisheries Service here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm here to the committee's request to just talk about the wildfish management policy. I've already provided the committee copies of two letters. One was a letter June 4th to Senator Brady Adams on House Bill 3609. We have copies of that. And then our comments of April 15th, 1999, to the Northwest Park Planning Council. They've been undergoing an artificial propagation review covering many of the same policy issues as the wildfish policy addresses, and I thought that might be helpful to you as well. Just basically, I'm here to answer questions you might have, but I do have a few comments to make. To kind of summarize the two letters, in our letter to Senate President Adams, we wanted to emphasize the importance we place on the state's wildfish management policy and its role in guiding Oregon salmon and steelhead recovery programs. This is important to the National Marine Fisheries Service as it ensures that Oregon's ongoing recovery efforts will likely be compatible with and supportive of federal requirements under the Endangered Species Act. Secondly, we want to stress the importance of sound science in guiding the need for and the application of such policies, and how scientific processes should be used to help guide how and when such policies should be updated. I've also, as I said, provided you a copy of a comment to the Park Planning Council to apprise you of that form. It's in the process of developing and placing a set of management policies to protect natural production of salmon and steelhead and to guide the use of hatcheries in Columbia River Basin. These are topics similar to those that are being addressed in the wildfish management policy. Our comments to the council stress the existence and the ongoing development of a number of important documents that we believe should be used in the planning, evaluating, and implementing the propagation programs for netting fish and for minimizing risk to the wild production. There are many forums outside the legislature right now that are looking at the role of hatchery and wild fish. I might mention three of the most important ones out there are the renegotiation of the Columbia River Fish Management Plan under the U.S. v. Oregon federal court case. That's ongoing. We review and revise hatchery programs for our responsibilities under the Endangered Species Act. That's a major reform going on. And as I mentioned before, the Northwest Park Planning Council's artificial propagation review is also looking at these same issues. In all of these forums, NIMS is attempting to forge a consistent outlook and outcome on the importance of wild fish production and the compatible use of the hatcheries in fish management and fish recovery. Last time I just got an offer for comments, I handed out a copy of an overhead. This is a overhead to the Power Plan Council staff presented last Thursday at a symposium on ocean conditions and its role in salmon. Kind of a theoretical schematic here, you can see we have the ocean conditions. There's a lot of variability. We're learning more and more that oceans vary over time, cyclically, annually. You have freshwater production, the diversity of the population, salmon produced,
selecting different behavioral things, life history patterns, and different strains within the same strain. We have a lot of diversity in the life history pattern of family steelhead. We have diversity in relationship conditions. And basically, what they wanted to stress in this conference is that you can have good ocean conditions and a lot of freshwater diversity, sand and air relating to different times and different places. And when those people sit together, you have high success, you have lots of productivity, you have lots of possible circles to come in. And B, you have very poor ocean conditions, you still have a lot of freshwater diversity, diversity in the sand and water. And one of those fits the conditions that are warm water, or whatever the other condition might be, and you have a condition where you have survival. So C, you have good ocean conditions, but poor diversity in the natural population, a lot of underutilized ocean pastures for salmon, for steelhead, and putting out in the ocean. And D, you have bad ocean conditions and bad freshwater diversity. Again, it's worth small extent, and ultimately, it will very much find the complete failure to narrow your diversity, your freshwater population, your life history template, and your ocean conditions of poor and ill natural level. We have complete failure. And generally, this wild fish policy, what we're trying to do is habitat restoration and capture management to try to maintain as much of the freshwater biological diversity, given that we can't control it, and in the long term, we have to accept.
Can I say, can I borrow?
Yes. Absolutely, Representative Thompson.
I think you have one more box in there called F, because you can have good ocean conditions and you can have all the biological diversity, but then you have another box called, or another component called F, which is not only marine mammals, but also birds and all your fish in the ocean, which is predation. You can have everything fit, and if you have an increase in the stock such as mackerel, that would turn around and destroy everything else you've got. It looks like to me like the short one box.
Well, yeah, I hear your point of making, I agree with it. I would probably include that in what I call good ocean conditions. Cooler temperature, the warm water, loving mackerel, or cow. If you like. Any other questions? I guess basically that's an introductory comment, and I'm happy to answer the questions about wildfish policy and things like that.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your opinion, we talk a lot about wild fish policy, but from an interest position, what is Oregon's wild fish policy? And, Mr. Chair, conversely, what is NMSA's wild fish policy?
We look at Oregon's wild fish policy, and we see directions to maintain, protect, restore habitat that can provide that freshwater diversity I showed in the schematic. And the best as we have the science today to make sure we operate our hatcheries so that we also do not emphasize or overly emphasize one life history pattern overall and lose all the others, either through our habitat or through our hatchery practices. And the idea here is to maintain that diversity so we can make the best use of whatever the ocean conditions might be.
Follow up. What's wild fish?
For us, it's a naturally produced fish. Yeah, we get into this wild fish, naturally produced fish space. And that's under the Endangered Species Act, we list naturally spawning, naturally produced fish.
Okay, so I've got a hatchery fish that makes it out to the ocean, completes its life cycle, comes back up to spawn, mm-hmm. and it is still not a natural fish. It's still not an But the eggs would be then, right?
Its offspring, if they're successful, would be naturally produced fish.
And so from your position, there would be no reason to prevent hatchery fish from coming up and spawning naturally.
Depends on the circumstances. If you're using a hatchery program to recover a depressed population, we do this in many places in the Pacific Northwest, and we use hatchery fish to try to rebuild the wild population. In our other hatchery programs, where there are mitigation programs designed primarily to supplement fisheries or replace lost habitat, we don't want to put, at this point in time, we don't want too many of the hatchery products spawning in with the wild population, because we're afraid it will reduce the fitness of that population.
That's a point that confuses me, because I'm going to make the assumption that any fish that's strong, that is strong enough to complete its life cycle and come up and make it clear up to spawn is a healthy, strong fish. And one would assume that if there are weaker strains, they don't make it. So it seems to me that you've got a contradiction here.
Well, there's been scientific studies and reviews of those studies about to what extent can hatchery production restore self-sustaining natural populations. And unfortunately, over the years, that's not generally how we've operated our hatcheries. We've just operated hatcheries pumping juvenile fish out to fisheries, getting the fish back to the hatcheries, and continuing the cycle. Some of those fish have strayed. We've never studied them in a lot of detail. So people weren't trying to use the hatchery to generate a fish that would spawn and produce successfully in the wild. So if they review the literature on that and the field information, it does not appear that hatcheries, the way they've been operated in the past, have been particularly successful or at all successful in providing a self-sustaining natural run. We are now experimenting with that idea broadly in the Northwest, because in many cases, places we don't have any choice, and hoping that we can revise the hatchery protocols to produce fish that when they do come back, they can spawn in the wild, produce offspring, and regenerate the wild population. But there's not a lot of evidence that that's a successful strategy.
Mr. Chair, I'll hand off to our friend at Thompson.
Before we see that baton handed off, and I see lots of the community members keying on the testimony, I'd like to thank Representative Cruz for that line of questioning. I felt the building moved just slightly. We have been after a definition of wild fish and some kind of idea of how the wild fish policies coordinate, whether or not the NIMS policy drives the Department of Fish and Wildlife, or the Department of Fish and Wildlife policy drives NIMS. And what I heard is that we don't want to overemphasize one lifestyle over another. So there is a place for hatchery fish, as long as it's not an overemphasis.
Correct.
But that also, that a wild fish would be a fish that naturally spawns, and it seems to me that I just heard you explain that a hatchery fish that completes its life cycle, that goes to gravel and spawns, although that fish would not be considered a wild fish, its progeny would be considered a wild fish.
Under the Endangered Species Act, that's true. Not all hatchery fish spawn and reproduce in the wild. Would we prefer to have them as listed fish? We can't measure the differences. We can't tell them apart at that point. Then the Endangered Species Act, we have to include them at that point in time. We cannot distinguish them at that point.
I think the frustration for many of us has been that we have seen our Department of Fish and Wildlife managing some of these returning spawners with baseball bats, and we wonder why that is an appropriate management technique. But yeah, the dead ones were a hatchery fish. I get it. I'm going to recognize Representative Thompson for questioning along those lines, but Mr. Smith, if you have something to volunteer, you just jump right on in here.
We fund a lot of hatcheries in the Pacific Northwest, and a lot of hatcheries do hopefully get surplus staff, and they are disposed of. And that's the proper use of that surplus.
Absolutely. I don't think there's a question about the disposal of surplus fish that returned to hatcheries. These were fish that wanted to go in a tributary and spawn, and were being prevented from doing that. We'll get you the videotape. It's a good Saturday night watch. I find it interesting that there seems to be nobody in the room from the Department of Fish and Wildlife to hear this testimony. Which comes from?
I'd like to go on tip for you. You go along with the theory that there virtually are very few genetically pure fish in the Northwest now because of our hatchery practices over the years.
There are certain streams that have no records of hatcheries stocking in those streams. We have streams where we used to stock fish, and genetically now we can't find any evidence that that initial stocking survived through time or lack of behavior. But there have been through spraying and through purposeful stocking over the years, there's been a lot of things in the fishing industry.
Okay. Second question, I'll try to tie it together then. Would you go along with the idea that we should establish ESUs so that we would be able to substantiate genetically pure stocks? And that was the purpose? Or when we establish ESUs rather than a stream-by-stream basis, what was your purpose when we went to the ESU system stream-by-stream?
Not my primary expertise, let me try that. They were looking, it was a matter of, it can be, I guess, groupers or splitters in the biological field, and you had to find kind of the middle ground, common sense area. The science can split populations up into very small areas and very small numbers of fish. But, or you can look at it species like a few counties in Alaska down in California. And the ESU is that kind of middle ground where they just, I guess, genetic life history traits that are similar as a group and something different from the other population, so they draw their system.
Okay. Now you can answer this, John. Part of the reason that we went to ESU is so that natural strain fish were grouped together, is what I was understanding, because of the geography of the situation that developed there. Then we have a hatchery practice. If we were to have hatchery practices that as long as those fish came from the same ESU, would you say that's a good hatchery practice?
Very definitely. We're not anti-hatchery. We feel that we just have to reform many of our hatchery practices so that the risk to the wild population is minimal. One of the things we are doing right now is encouraging or regulating switching to local group stocks for hatchery programs so that when they do stray, one of the reasons for that, when they do stray, they can have less negative effect on the wild population. I think feed them to that false strip example. You want your hatchery, if your hatchery is using local group stocks and you're infusing wild fish into that group stock on a regular basis, you're not domesticating or allowing that hatchery population to diverge over time from the wild fish, then they're more similar when your hatchery fish can stray into the wild. Hopefully, number one, they may contribute, and number two, they won't be that detrimental.
Can I go ahead and just make some case? Yeah, I agree with what you've said so far, but it bothers me when in the case of Falkirk, where you have fish from the same ESU, and what they've done is simply move the hatchery run forward, or actually back in the year, because they took their eggs, moved it forward because they took their eggs earlier and earlier. They didn't change the genetics. And what was reported to us, and you're welcome to make a comment, was that those fish were destroyed because they were not good fish, if the genetics remained the same.
There's various reasons I have heard dealing that close to the false fish example. For various reasons, the state decided they wouldn't continue that hatchery program. They shut it down. And shutting it down, they killed the fish coming back. My understanding is that in the future, they start a new hatchery program in there, which they may do in the future. They would start from these local wild stocks that have a full range of life history diversity, like say, vibrant, and produce a product that is hopefully would be more successful under the various ocean and freshwater conditions that hatchery fish has been. That you start it from the local population and not have selectively always taken the early eggs to end up in the early arriving fish. That over time leads to disaster. your fish coming back in. If you want to take your eggs or roots off the full length of the long fish.
So it, you just, those fish were requested to be destroyed, if I understand, by National Marine Fisheries Service because the fish were earlier, not because of genetic reasons, because those fish were came from another river, which was just north of that river, and they were the genetically in the same ESU and similar fish. And I'm worried that this kind of a policy is going to just go out and beat up hatcheries rather than do a good science.
No, it's, first of all, mine, we didn't order those fish destroyed. I'm not even sure what the hatchery is. I believe Oregon, in developing their coastal plan, and I was involved in working with the Department of State on that, that they were cutting back their coastal production at that time for various reasons. So we didn't get into specifics of this hatchery or how you dispose of those fish. What they did, and I, my understanding of destroying those fish, though, is that that would follow generally the guidance that NIMS would give. If they're going to start a new program, doesn't mean you can't have a happy there in the future, but when you start it up, again, you get from the whole diversity of your local population. You've got your group stock under our current understanding of how to make a hatchery most successful, not based on the past.
One last question, and I'll let you come up to this. But under the Endangered Species Act, aren't you supposed to protect the wild fish? I mean, here's a genetically, maybe not perfect fish, but it still has the genetics of the local ESU, and you've gone out and basically told them to destroy that run, and that was the genetics of that ESU. If that would have been come from another ESU, I wouldn't have had a problem. But that came from that ESU, and under the Endangered Species Act, you basically made it violate the Endangered Species Act.
No. We only list the nasty food fish, but these fish coming back to the hatchery, they're not listed fish. If we hadn't, we'd not listed them. Yet we listed them, it's only the nasty food fish. So the hatchery fish coming back that were born and raised in the hatchery, they're not listed food fish. We're not destroying the fish. If we felt those fish were essential, we've done this with some hatcheries, Upper Columbia Steelhead. We listed the hatchery fish as well because it was the wild stock was so low that hatchery product was the best depository of ESU genetics that we have left. Our whole future of trying to rebuild that population up there is going to be from that hatchery product. We didn't have any choice. So we do list hatchery fish when we think they're essential to recovery. We didn't do that. We haven't done that very quickly.
You've done a good job answering the question.
There was a time when I was thinking this man has no future in this business because his answers are logical and they seem to make sense. Let me tell you something. There are some questions that your testimony raises. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has a policy not connected with the shutting down of hatchery programs of destruction of returning spawns that are hatchery fish. And a discontinuing stocking and moving water. They're essentially going toward a stocking and still water policy. But the answers that you've given, I think, need to be carefully cross-connected with the some of the answers that we were given relative to the destruction of the run in the Alsea. It had nothing to do with the hatchery closure. It had to do with attractive nuisance. We were apparently attracted to sea lions in the estuary, and they were afraid that those sea lions would prey on the few remaining wild fish that they thought would be returning. So we killed 6,600 returning potential spawners to protect 109 estimated wild fish that would spawn later. It gets Byzantine here pretty quick.
I'm not aware of all the details.
I'm sure. And as far as that's a good story, and I'd stick to it if I were you. The Representative King has been patient about some questions, and we'll go back to Representative Meshler and Senator Carna has some questions. All of us do. So, Representative King.
Thank you. My comments kind of follow up on Representative Booz and Elton Perry's. And my understanding is a difference of about 50 words for the word snow, and that the differences between them often can make the difference between life and death and making choices. it seems to me that we don't have enough adjectives, you know, for describing different kinds of fish. Because we've asked the definition of what is a wild fish, and you gave a good succinct answer. But it's also then following along in your comments that, you know, it's clear that it's important we have preserve all the different characteristics of the different runs and the different timings and the behaviors. And if we have, you know, a predominant amount of fish that are taken from a narrow time, and you know, from one gene stock, and that becomes very dominant, you know, in that stream, maybe we're losing the variable characteristics, and that it seems like we need something different from something that's, you know, as pure as we can identify, something that's, you know, maybe a wild fish from another stock that's been transplanted, maybe a hatchery fish that you're going to treat as endangered because your pool is so low. It just seems like we don't have enough descriptions of the different kinds of situations we're dealing with. And then when we, you know, are sitting around this table trying to figure out what kind of policy to deal with, quote, the wild fish, then we always, you know, get off on these unavoidable, I think, necessary discussions of, well, what is a wild fish? What are we trying to protect? Is there really a wild fish? And it seems like we need, you know, maybe, you know, 10 or maybe 20 different definitions of the different characteristics that we're trying to identify so we can relate them and have some policy.
Well, this is, I don't disagree with what you're saying. It's kind of a continuum, and we don't have the data on all this. Is not real black and white. You just have to go with the best data you have and the best theory you have. And go out, and it's the priority, go out and collect more information faster and learn from it, you know what to do. We're trying to do that. We've got to turn all over the Upper Columbia Snake Basin. We're doing research right here up in Alaska on this wild hatchery fish issue. Find out just what is the effect of a well-run hatchery program. We know that poorly run hatchery programs can be detrimental to the massive population. Now the question is this new reform that we're promoting, what's the effect of that reformed modern day program with respect to those fishing lines? Do we need to cut that?
It's just a quick follow. It seems like, you know, if we're trying to do something that was in music, which is, you know, classical music, which is very complicated, it seems like in the definition we're using in terms of what kind of fish we have, it's like we've got three chords and we're trying to make that work with the other and don't have enough categories.
Okay. Smith, you mentioned earlier to Senator Adams regarding National Marine Fisheries opinion on some issues. And in that letter, you indicated that National Marine Fisheries disagreed, or indicated that the Oregon wild fish management policy was inadequate as a conservation measure. Can you explain that?
I'm sorry, you said it was inadequate?
Yes. It was inadequate as a conservation measure.
I'm sorry, I'm out of time for that. We've supported the wild fish policy based on the information we have today. There are a few areas in it. I reviewed the policy, and actually as we negotiated the Oregon plans with COHO, there are some areas that we thought it could be more strict. But as an overall policy, generally pretty sure.
So in your opinion, the Oregon wild fish policy is it an acceptable standard?
It's a very good policy. I think if we were to write it today, we'd write a few words and a few numbers a little bit differently. I understand it in some of the discussion before the hearing here today, there's need for exception always, and as I read the policy, I see flexibility in that policy for exception. We're planning to do more restoration activities, again, primarily above the dams and the upper basins, where we are going to be much more aggressive with our hatchery programs for one of two reasons. One, we don't have any choice, and number two, we want to see what the results scientifically would be where we use more of a hatchery system. So those are kind of exceptions to this kind of a policy, but this policy allows for exceptions.
national policy. Smith, you know of any state that has a better policy than we have?
I understand the state of Washington adopted a wildfish policy, but I have not read it. No, I'm not.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Smith, I'm concerned that as our expenditures, both federal and state, we're having more and more difficulty, it seems to me, finding the funding to run our programs. And it appears that our conditions in the oceans are improving, since temperatures are improving, and I'm hearing from my local fishermen in my district that the ocean fishermen think there's a lot of fish out there right now. We're going to have some good numbers this fall. Shouldn't this be the time that we should be putting extra effort into stocking the ocean through our hatchery programs and really be pushing us in local?
You know, again, going back to last Thursday in the symposium that the Power Planning Council hosted, that's one of the big questions we have of the science people at this point. One of the things we know is when the ocean conditions turned bad in the 70s, we maintained or increased our hatchery programs, and we increased fewer and fewer adults with more and more coho going out in the ocean. We now have a different interpretation of what caused that than we did back in the 70s. But there may be a strategy. We fund 20-some-odd hatcheries ourselves in the Columbia Basin. There may be a strategy where if we can predict these ocean conditions and the carrying capacity of the ocean improving, it might be a good time to up your hatchery production if you can harvest it and protect the wild stock. And then as the conditions decline again, cut back on your hatchery production. But that's for hatcheries that are, you know, you're putting fish out for your primary purposes, you want them to be harvested. For hatcheries on a conservation purpose, you're trying to restore natural populations. We think the safest way to build up, whether it's coho or the steelhead on the coast, is as these ocean conditions improve and survival's increased, then we'll build up those populations from the natural fish themselves. And there may not be any need to supplement them with hatcheries, because number one, we don't know what the effect of that will be, and number two, it's expensive. And the more hatchery programs in every stream or major tributaries, the more expensive recovery action.
Smith, I wasn't going to readdress this issue, but you've raised my interest enough. I think I need to restate the question, and that is that from what you just said, if you get the stock for those hatcheries from the local ESUs, as Representative Thompson was just indicating, wouldn't that help build the wild stocks? And wouldn't that be an effective way to bring the total fishers back, both the hatcheries and the wild stocks?
It would be
it seems to me that that's the question, as opposed to who cares if they stray, if your genetics are from the same ESU.
If we have improving ocean conditions over time, putting hatcheries fish out there is an effective strategy to build up the number of fish available for fishing. We've got to have a technique to fish on them such that we don't over-harvest the weak wild stock. Is it a strategy that's effective to rebuild your wild stock? If your wild stock is going to start increasing because ocean's gotten better, I'd say let them go and let them increase on their own. If you've got a whole area of a basin, or you have a whole watershed where the fish are extirpated, they've been there extinct, then you might want to go in and reintroduce them. The safest way for the long-term productivity of these salmon is to let them build back up on their own. So they can build up very quickly, particularly coho, if we have good ocean conditions.
I thought I heard you in your early remarks from my first question, I believe, state that the hatcheries had an impact on the loss of our fisheries in the 70s. But if that's true, then could you prioritize or put impact weight on what to harvest? We had a huge fleet going at that time with the reducing resource as well. We also had increase in predation. Could you prioritize or put a factor on where you would rate those different impacts?
It's hard to kind of put them all in line. Harvest at some point on the coast was a major factor of decline for coho salmon. We had 80% harvest rate. And wild stock can't sustain that. Lower Columbia River, we had for years and years, we had harvest rates of 90-95%. Again, the theory was that that was safe for the hatchery fish. We got plenty of fish back to the hatcheries. The wild stock couldn't sustain it. By the time people figured that out, frankly, the policy back then was nobody cared. We'll just provide with the hatcheries. And that was the wrong policy. At the time, the information just said it. But no, harvest itself was a tremendous problem on coho in the Lower Columbia River.
This issue has been brought to my attention from some of the fishermen and the older people in my community. And that is the historical data as to whether, as an example, coho is native to certain regions. The question is, how far back does your history, your research go to establish whether all of these species we're trying to save are actually native or whether they were introduced species at some time?
Well, I think we've got fairly good data about coho being native, steelhead, chinook. I'm not aware that there's any. There's been some introductions elsewhere in the state. I know years ago, sockeye were introduced in the Willamette Basin, and a fairly interesting program was run out of one of the reservoirs in the Willamette. They had sockeye in the Willamette for a while, and they figured that was the right thing to do. That program died out. So there has been an introduction of fish around in Oregon. I'm not aware of whole species being introduced on the Oregon coast.
So you have historical data indicating that the coho on some of our rivers are truly native and were not introduced by the hatchery programs 150 years ago, 120 years ago.
I'm not that familiar with every stream and all the hatchery programs. I'm being told in Puget Sound up in Washington, there are streams that if they had Chinook salmon in them, they were gone long time ago, and now they had Chinook in them again, and they're largely hatchery strays, just constant strays from local big hatchery programs. So you can't put, I know you can't put fish into otherwise vacant habitats and hatchery strays. But whether or not they were there native originally and were wiped out either naturally or by human cause,
okay. One more question, if I might, Mr. Chair, since you can have the gavel back now. Do we have any success stories of National Marine Fisheries Service recovery programs where we have increased the fisheries population that we can tie to the recovery policies?
More than NMFF, the whole region's been investing a lot of money, and there's been a lot of thinking that we don't have the runs coming back, and therefore we've wasted the money or whatever the region. I think if, in fact, the ocean conditions are turning around and some of the scientists there think that's the case, what we've been investing in a lot in our fish passage in the Columbia and in the habitat is preserving that freshwater diversity. And now is the time, in my opinion, for that diversity to express itself with better ocean conditions in larger run sizes. If you've got bad ocean conditions, including the predators, natural or introduced, that freshwater diversity doesn't have a chance to express itself. We've invested a lot of money, in my opinion, in trying to maintain and maybe increase that freshwater diversity. Now with the payoff.
I just have to share for one more question. I have concern on how we measure ocean conditions. I know we measure temperature, and you mentioned predation. Do we measure food chain? Do we measure habitat structure? Do we know what's happening there with our different harvest methods? And do we know what's happening to our food chain with our varying types of harvest? The predation, I wonder how closely we monitor that. And is it one of the factors that's keying heavily on what's going on with our recovery?
Well, I think obviously the ocean's a very important part of the salmon's life cycle. And again, the symposium last week by the Public Planning Council was designed to emphasize to people that it is very important. And as a result of that conference, I'm assuming that we're going to see a lot more research in the ocean to try to not only figure out the cycles and their effect on the food, the salmon, and then the salmon themselves out there, the predator-prey relationships. It's very expensive and very difficult to go do research out in the ocean and determine anything. But now people are realizing they need to understand that better. And so I think, you know, 10 years from now we'll have a lot more information than we have today. But, you know, the last few years they've learned a lot about, you know, predation, the mackerel. I mean, the ocean was always just a black box. And as, well, the hatchery technology has only been successful for several decades now. And when it really got going in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we were pumping out more and more hatchery fish and getting back more and more adult fish because we had, as you now know, we had better ocean conditions. That strategy was not effective in the late 70s and 80s and early 90s. So we're actually kind of learning about what works here.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Farrell. First off, in comment, I'm not sure it's quite accurate to blame what happened in the ocean on what good or bad hatchery programs. But I'm still back to my original question and trying to understand what a wild fish is. And maybe I'm just slower than most on picking this stuff up, but let me run a little scenario here. Okay, we have adult male and female come up the river, spawn, and God's image, universe, and everything's right with the world. Okay, we take these same two fish, the same male and female, and we pull them out. They spawn, let's say, in a hatch box, and we release the fry back into that same piece of water. How are those fry fundamentally different from the ones that start out in the gravel? How does that make them fundamentally different, and so they're no longer wild?
My understanding is it's mainly the point of when you took the fish and you put them in the egg box program and you put them in the hatchery, was there selection pressures there that otherwise would not have occurred if that fish stayed the whole time in the ocean? And if you do that generation after generation, do you then end up with a different fish? The definition thing is tough. The Endangered Species Act, the goal is self-sustaining, naturally produced population. That's what we try, if we have to list, that's what we're listing on, and that's our recovery goal. Naturally produced, and ultimately a self-sustaining natural population. Once you have that self-sustaining natural population of sufficient size and distribution, then you can delist the population. It doesn't mean you can't have hatcheries involved with that population, but if the hatcheries were pulled off or shut down, that population has got to be able to sustain itself in the wild. And that's how we interpret the directions of the Endangered Species Act.
But if you've got a hatchery produced wild cross that is genetically identical to the naturally produced fish, how can you say they are not naturally produced fish? You can't, other than the fact that they're going to have a clear fin, you won't be able to tell them apart. What is the difference?
Could I ask a question similar to this to the gentleman here?
Yeah.
Do you see a difference?
You're recognizing the representative?
Do you see a difference between a child that's born in a hospital and a child that's born in a natural birth at home? Yeah. It's virtually the same thing. There's a parallel here that I don't agree with National Marine Fisheries Service philosophy. I mean, if the genetics are the same, basically the fish is the same.
Yes, and the fish, the genetics are taken into the hatchery, yes, it's the same. The problem is what you do in that hatchery selectively. If you take one of the self-hunting, you want to get your spawning over it and take over the early fish. You do that generation after generation. Next thing you know, all that left is an early wild fish. Now, if you have drought conditions going into October some year, and streams fish can't get in, all backing up out of the estuary, suddenly your selective pressure just causes you a major problem with your hatchery. And so it's the selection that man has done inadvertently or advertently in the hatchery, and the thing, the hatchery, the raising fish and densities and the raceway, the concrete raceway, feeding food from the surface of the raceway and the feeding from the bottom. Those things all lead over time the fish is less able to survive in the wild. Now, that fish may be able to survive in the wild because conditions are all good, freshwater habitat and ocean, but when they get bad, then you have a fish less fit to make that survive.
One last question and then I'll get out of it. Then explain to me why the Aquinnan Goose River, which are the most introduced rivers on the whole West Coast, that's where Oraquin, have the largest natural run today. There's something wrong in your science.
Go look at the numbers.
They have the largest wild stocks. There's something wrong in your science.
I'm not sure that's the result of a large aquaculture program.
Well, but if they were a case of those hatchery fish destroyed those, if the scenario you're going, that they destroy the natural runs, those would have the least amount of fish. Instead, those that were the most introduced rivers on the West Coast also have the strongest, healthiest natural runs. There's something wrong in your science. You need to go back and analyze that and come back with an answer.
This shouldn't sound
familiar. Sorry about getting excited. It's okay. It's frustrating when I think the natural runs are no good.
There's nobody on this committee that isn't, hasn't become passionate over this issue.
Thank you for deferring.
However, I think what I'm hearing, Mr. Smith, say that is possibly a little disconnected with the issue of Representative Cruz's questioning about wild fish, is it's not the fish that's different, it's the management, it's the adaptive management that we've used either to manipulate earlier runs or inadvertently manipulated them. So it has less to do with the fish per se than it does with the adaptive management that we use to change the dynamics of that fish's, and I said lifestyle, I guess it's not lifestyle, fish don't have lifestyle, they have a life history. So anyway,
look, I just might mention too, is obviously based on the information we have today, we're training our hatchery managers to do the right thing, as best we understand what we have in natural fishery, the whole research group, whose sole purpose is to study ways of producing from a hatchery a more wildlife fish. So instead of cramming fish in great densities in a concrete raceway and feeding them pellets from the surface, we're trying different substrates, different rearing conditions, so that fish is likely not getting the kind of selective pressures that we're afraid the hatchery fish get in the tank. So we're trying to improve the techniques. We're going to be seeing more and more kind of experimental hatcheries in the future that are more wildlife in their construction and their feeding and all of that. Again, trying to produce fish that we don't select in that hatchery process.
Representative Cruz was generous enough to defer to Representative Thompson. Representative Cruz, did you want to follow this on?
I guess, Mr. Chair, I was glad to defer to the good representative, but these fish are all, for their entire life, under selective pressure. That really seems like a smokescreen. And what I really hope, Mr. Chair, is sometime before I die, and I hope that's not real soon, I will know what a wild fish is.
Representative Cruz, thank you. And I think we did hear testimony earlier this year in front of the committee about the new design of fish hatcheries using textures, colors, and different structures that avoid the concrete and raceway syndrome, and then different methods of feeding. I think the Native Americans have a demonstration they could do at the new hatchery in Corbett or near Corbett that incorporates some of those features, and they brought some of those features to share with the committee. So I think we are learning some adaptive management. Thank you. Representative Jensen's next in the queue, and then we go to Representative Thompson.
Okay.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your permission, I'll deviate from the wild fish policy for a moment and ask if you're familiar with the study or the report coming out of the Department of Fisheries and Ocean in Canada, and a a statement in that study or report that said that the harvest in Canada and Alaska may have more to do with the fish runs in the Columbia River and the Washington-Oregon coast than all of the habitat issues may have as much to do or more to do with the fish runs and all of the habitat issues that we are attempting to address in this area. And if you're familiar with it, what's your response or reaction to it?
I've not seen a report or study that indicated that kind of level of harvest. Not in this day and age.
I think about a 96 date on that.
I haven't seen that. No, I might mention, in my office I have a framed saying from a geneticist out of Montana. And it says, never throw away a good hatchery stock. You may be throwing away a solution rather than a problem. And so, you know, I just kind of mentioned that is that while we're trying to reform hatchery, it doesn't mean we're anti-hatchery or we think that all hatcheries are bad. We just want to make them better. Just the case of science we have today.
Mr. Smith, let me assure you that whatever the intention is in this communication is somehow translated into outright hostility at the Department of Fish and Wildlife against hatchery. And that is a constant thread. I think every one of the committee members has encountered it. Certainly the Native American people have encountered it. And when we ask about where that comes from, very often the answer is that hostility originates in policies at National Marine Fisheries Service. I am hearing from you today that there's an adaptive management policy, a learning curve, the recognition that hatcheries are a very useful tool under many circumstances, and it seems to me a much more pragmatic approach and a much more adaptive approach to managing fish hatcheries than what we've been hearing from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And if I've misapprehended that or misstated that, I'd invite the committee members to correct me. The chair has just a few questions. Now I think we need to move to the next section of our agenda if the committee has no more questions. The history of relationship between the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Wild Fish Management Policy and the Hatchery Policy has been one of litigation, and I wondered, can you characterize the relationship between National Marine Fisheries Service and Native American sovereigns under the ESA? What is the relationship?
Well, National Marine Fisheries Service, but we have our ESA responsibilities. We have our federal government's treaty plus responsibilities. Both of them are very important. This was one of the main topic of negotiation in USD Oregon. One of the main topics is balancing these two directions. Generally, the Endangered Species Act, we see them as though, in the long run, very compatible, because in the Endangered Species Act, in the long run, is trying to build up populations of salmon in that diversity that, in the long run, will, when you have good ocean conditions, give you more harvestable surplus. And it gives you a greater chance of these stocks not, you know, going extinct or winking out. And so ESA, as I see it in that diagram, is designed to build up that diversity, and that's in our opinion, a long range interest of the tribe and our treaty trust responsibility. So we see the two as compatible.
And isn't this a co-managership
relationship? There's a lot of compromise going on these experiments and how we design them are trying different perspectives of the science between hatcheries and wild fish, and that's the kind of negotiation going on right now.
I think there again is another example of differences in understanding between the characterization that you've made of National Marine Fisheries Service policy and the one that we hear from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding co-managership. Then the last question I have to do with strays. It appears to me that straying in natural populations and straying in hatchery populations is a feature of the creature. I mean, they just do sometimes go back to different streams, and it seems also that straying is a mechanism to increase or maintain genetic diversity within populations. yet I've heard National Marine Fisheries Service try to put a limit on the number of strays that they will allow in a river system, and I guess I wondered where that magic number comes from. I think it's no more than 10%, or, you know, how does that policy shake out? Is that science or is that inspiration? What is that?
Natural populations do stray, generally, my understanding, at very low levels, unless you have a natural disaster that might, like St. Helens blowing up, or a drought that might cause fish to stray in greater numbers. Straying is a natural phenomenon of salmon. It helps create the diversity in the population. It's a matter of degree. And my agency hosted some years ago a workshop with the scientists about the straying issue. And generally the advice out of that group was that we should hold stray rates to low levels, and it depends upon whether or not the broodstock was from the ESU or not. If you have a non-indigenous or an alien broodstock, you want to hold those stray rates to very low levels. Because, and again, 1 or 2 years may not be a problem, but over time, and over, then you start changing the genetic makeup, potentially, of the population. If you have a local hatchery stock, infusing wild fish into that broodstock, and those fish stray, the science indicates to us that should you could have higher stray rates and less impact. And so when we sit down with Oregon or anybody else and we try to work these issues out, we try to set objective goals about stray rates. And they differ based on the broodstock in the hatchery.
Thank you. We're going to move to the next section of our agenda, but I want to thank you for your testimony today. It's been very important, I think, for the committee to meet you and hear this these clarifications on wild fish policy. The committee will be inviting you back periodically, and I just very much enjoyed the testimony and found it to be very interesting. I'm sure all the committee members did as well. Thank you for being here. We're going to switch gears and have the second part of our agenda today, which is the an overview of the Umpqua Land Exchange Project, and I'd like to ask to have come forward to Mr. Mark Kelly and anyone that he has brought with him to help explain how this issue would affect natural resource management policy in Oregon. Right here, I'll take this for you. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you for the time.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, just for the record, state your name and then begin your testimony. You have the floor.
Okay. My name is Mark Kelly. I'm the project director of the Umpqua Land Exchange Project. To my right is Dr. Steve Hobbs, who is the captain of the consulting science team for this project. Next to him, Dr. Tim Harden, a fisheries biologist, and next to him, Dr. John Sessions, who is a modeler at Forest Engineering.
Gentlemen, welcome.
The Umpqua Land Exchange Project is a privately initiated project. It began in 1994. It was really the brainchild, if you will, and the emotional stamina for the project came from Aaron Jones, who is the owner and president of the Clinic of Sawmill Company. And his belief was that after he bought some land in Douglas County, Oregon, is that there might be a better way to manage the landscape in that heavily checkerboarded land down there, which we'll get into very quickly here, that would both improve habitat and stabilize timber supply using the current regulatory structure. And with that as a sort of a basis, Aaron went back to Washington, D.C., and worked with Neil Goldschmidt and Senator Mark Hatfield. And in 1995, the project was formalized in the Umpqua River Basin Land Exchange Project legislation that was approved by the Congress of the United States. The project consists of a management committee which oversees its daily operations that consists of Aaron Jones, John Blackwell, who recently retired as president of the World Forestry Center, and Douglas County Commissioner Doug Robertson. In addition, there is a policy committee which is made up of a variety of interests in, that reside in Douglas County. And it consists of conservation groups and other governmental agencies, both state and federal, as well as folks off the Umpqua Watershed Council, and folks who represent other interests like the steamboaters and ag groups, etc. In addition to that, there is a science sort of policy subcommittee that we use that's chaired by Dr. Logan Norris, that gives advice to Steve and the consulting science team on technical issues. And it's got federal agencies on it, people from the research station, BMW, as well as conservation groups and folks from the Forest Products Industry. The purpose of this project, from its get-go, has been to see whether or not, as I stated earlier, we could both stabilize timber supply. And what that means in the Northwest Forest Plan is it stabilized timber supply at levels as specified in the Northwest Forest Plan, and at the same time improve ecological health over anything that we've accomplished to date if you look across the landscape, and at the same time do that within the current regulatory structure. You have in front of you a list of letters from folks who have endorsed the project based on its scientific merit. I say that because I don't think anybody is yet prepared to endorse a given land exchange. That's become a heated topic in the West over the past several years. But the letters that are in front of you are quite diverse. They start with the governor. It consists of a signature, a letter that is signed by all of the industrial landowners in the Umpqua Basin, plus the Douglas Small Woodlands Association. A very strong endorsement of the project from Dr. Norm Johnson, who I think many of you are probably familiar with, and then Oregon Trout and the National Wildlife Federation. So we've done our very best to make this a not only not a nonpartisan project, but a project in which lots of diverse interests are welcome at the table. To date, the project has expended about $3.6 million. $1,750,000 of that has come from congressional appropriations, and the balance has come from private sources or foundations. We're about to talk with you about not just project structure, but the actual dynamics of where we're about to head. And in order to finish the piece you're going to hear about today, we will spend about another $1.4 to $1.5 million. This project, which looks out across the landscape and is capable of spatially modeling a whole wide variety of habitat, is, right here in Oregon, the only effort of this magnitude in North America. It is the first time in North America we have stepped up to the plate and said, in order to understand timber supply and habitat, you have to look at across the landscape and assign values to it. And it's exciting. And Aaron, I don't know how many know him, but he's stubborn, and when he gets this idea in his head, he likes to see it through. And it is really because of his absolute dedication to this project we've been able to put together all the other resources to make it run. I should point out that not up there with us, but behind me is Dale Riddle. Dale is legal counsel for Seneca, but I would say he's also here today representing the three people who I work for directly, which is Aaron and John Blackwell, and County Commissioner Doug Robertson. Having given that as a very brief introduction, I'd like to ask Steve, and I can guarantee you that they'd much prefer to be called Steve, Ken, and John than they would Doctor. I made that mistake too many times. But I'd ask Steve if he could kind of use the overhead and give a total project overview, who makes up the team and how the whole thing really functions. And then we'll go immediately to the model and that's the exciting part.
Thank you very much, Mark. As Mark said, introducing me earlier, I'm Steve Hobbs, and I'm the coordinator, leader, if you will, of the consulting science team that has worked actually over the last 4 years to assemble this methodology. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a very quick snapshot overview of the science involved here. And then I'm going to turn it over to John Sessions, who's our chief modeler. And John is actually going to demonstrate this for you live, real time, on the screen. I think you're going to find it fascinating. So what I'm going to do now is move over to the overhead and show you a few overheads to kind of give you the big picture of what we're doing.
while John's doing that, I might add that we've had a lot of cooperation, and we're working very closely with ODFW, Oregon Department of Forestry, DEQ, and the Natural Resources staff in the government office. It's been a collaborative, maybe too strong of a word, but certainly a strong sense of cooperation to develop the project where it is today.
Okay, I guess the first thing that I'd like to do is kind of give you an encapsulated version of what the goals of this project are. First of all, to examine alternative land ownership patterns. Is there a land ownership pattern out there other than the one that exists today? Which includes ecological health, if you will, or more specifically, habitat for species at risk, such as the northern spotted owl, while at the same time maintaining timber supply from both private and public land. Now, I'm also asked in agreement and understanding the Capital Association of Williamson County. That also means that we will not put a strain on this methodology in any scenarios or analysis that we do will not result in a net decrease in the amount of acreage in federal land or reduction in timber receipts for our Williamson County. So basically, two methods: maintain timber supply while improving ecological health or habitat for species at risk. Okay, just a quick snapshot view of the Umpqua Basin. Now, all of you are familiar with the checkerboard pattern in Western Oregon as a result of OMC land. This just illustrates it, what it looks like in the Umpqua Basin, which is essentially a 3 million acre area that is essentially Douglas County. This large lot out here, of course, is what is 4 foot land. This, of course, is large as BLM land here next to the industrial land and some of the industrial land as well. Now, Mark very quickly told you about organizational structure, and I want to just reemphasize that, because this is, I think, a unique organization. We have the management committee, which Mark described for you. I'd also like to point out that the World Forestry Center has fiduciary responsibility for the funds involved in the project. We then have the project director, which is Mark Kelly, who I report to, the consulting science team, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And then, very importantly, the science subcommittee that has scientists or technical people from all these different organizations who provide technical scientific advice to the management committee and to the consulting science team. Truly a collaborative effort. Now, let's just take a quick look at the science team. And the reason I put this overhead up here is I want to just stress the fact that this is a group of individuals that have been working very closely together for 4 years. This is a multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary problem. I think if you look at some of the disciplines listed here, I think you can see that, in fact, that is the approach that we are taking. We've got a lot of different disciplines working together to develop solutions for this analytical methodology to the question at hand. Let's talk just very quickly about the science that's involved in this process. First of all, we want to develop and test the methodology, say, a pilot study, if you will. And what we've ever done before, this is truly a unique and scientific endeavor. No one has ever done this before. Independent peer review. Now, we have gone through and we've developed a methodology. We did it as a pilot study, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. And then we had an independent scientific review. We were totally, we had no influence whatsoever on scientists that were brought in to review our project. This was led by Dr. John Hill, Professor Emeritus of Forestry from UC Berkeley. And he brought in scientists from around the country and British Columbia to review the project. Now, from this, we are making changes and improvements from this particular research, and we'll have a better product as a result of it. We're currently revising the methodology based on peer review and other input that we've done from more cooperatives. Our next step is to apply the methodology to the landscape, and more specifically, we want to apply it to an area we call the Coke Range Unit in the Umpqua Basin, which is about 675,000 acres. That, of course, we hope to be able to identify land for potential exchange consideration among willing partners. And that's the key part, among willing partners. So we're going to run our scientific analysis, and John will demonstrate that here in just a moment. And and look at the potential for improving ecological health and adaptive species dividends, while at the same time maintaining timber supply. Now, about the basic strategy of the fall. Essentially, the computer model that John and the team of scientists have developed says timber supply is kind of a constraint. At the same time, by rearranging pieces of landscape, ownership, if you will, in this model, and looked at all the different possible combinations, we're talking about millions and millions of comparisons, take a look at are there different patterns that can improve habitat for species of this while maintaining timber supply. And essentially what we do is we take the current landscape right here without land exchanges, and we model that over 100 years. We have programs that grow the timber, harvest the timber according to what the various forms of coal and management plans are. We do this over a 100-year period. So this landscape is changing. There are three dimes, harvested, habitat conditions are changing. So we have to model the existing conditions as it is today.
Dr. Hobb.
Yeah.
Is the model floor plan or in plan or one that we'd be familiar with?
Okay, pardon?
Is the model that you're using on the base, is that floor plan or in plan, or is it an input-output model that we'd be familiar with?
It's a totally unique model, and one of the basic models that uses is what we call Oregon, and that's our growth yield model, which is well-tested and developed for Oregon State University. One session can answer that question probably better than I can.
And that's called the ORFLAN model? What was the name of the model?
We call it the UNFLAW model.
The UNFLAW model.
UNFLAW Land Exchange
Model. Okay, and did that come out of the Forestry Intensive Research Program?
And I was part of that program, by the way.
I know that, sir.
That was a different program, but organized.
Thank you.
Okay, so we take the existing condition, we grow the forest floor, we harvest timber, the managers are full of it, and then we crank up this computer algorithm, if you will, that John has developed with his colleagues, to take a look at alternative land types. And we run that out for 100 years. And then we compare the scenarios. And we ask ourselves, do things get better? We can evaluate habitat changes, objective increments, or any other central increments that you want, the individual species or species in aggregate. For example, we can look at all the wildlife species, all the fish species of which there are six for the model. Or we can look at these in aggregate or individual species, for any piece of land, for any ownership, for any watershed. So this is an integrated model that looks at multiple variables, species and habitat conditions, across multiple ownerships through time. Nobody has done that. And rearranging the landscape to look at alternative patterns. So our basic strategy then is to compare with the existing conditions to see if things get done. That's what comes to the okay, now I told you earlier we've got a pilot study, and that is outlined here on this particular overhead in blue, an area of about 97,000 acres. We felt it was important to learn how to walk before we met the grant. So we tested this methodology here and provided our cooperators with a report on them. Just a quick snapshot of the pilot study area, primarily industrial land intermixed with Bureau of Land Management land. All the heads in agricultural land zone. Now, where we're headed, we divided the Umpqua Basin up into what we call ecological areas. Very similar to the physiographic provinces that the Forest Service and the PLM and other federal agencies use, but also very similar to the ecoregions that the EPA developed. Very, very similar. Here you can see where the pilot study is located, and here is the coal drain in that 675,000 acre area that I mentioned earlier. This is the area we're getting ready to move into. Okay, we're done testing, we're revising the methodology, we want to do it for real. Just give you a quick look at the ownership pattern here. A lot of BLM industrial land, LA State Forest is in here, the forest sort of behind here. Okay, before I turn this over to John, the last thing I'd like to say is that this model permits evaluation of ecological and timber supply implications of alternative ownership patterns. This is truly a unique effort, and I don't know of anything else like it. When you think about the ownership pattern we have, the federal county checkerboard pattern, all the various problems associated with that, this is a potential way to evaluate alternative ownership patterns that may provide some very important solutions to the critical issues that we face, not only in Douglas County, but other areas of Western Oregon as well. Now, that's a very quick snapshot of what we're doing. It's a lot more complicated than what I've indicated here. I'd like to do now, with your permission, to turn it over to John Sessions and have him demonstrate this model for you.
Thank you, Sessions.
Okay, thank you. This is an area, this hydroclimatic area that the Moss has described. It's about 100,000 acre area that's virtually divided equally between the federal agencies, in this case the BLM, and the forest industry and non-industrial owners. Although you might not the acronyms, you might not be able to follow, generally the ownership in red are the forest industry, and the ones in various shades of green are the Bureau of Land Management. And I'd like to talk a little bit about these because we're going to talk about the management retention in a moment. But the very darker green here, which I'll look into perhaps in a little more detail. The darker green are the riparian reserves that the federal agencies recognize under the Northwest Forest Plan. This other dark green are the Lake Professional Reserves, and if you can see some sharp turns down here, which there is a little in the area, those are the lands that are available in general for timber production in this area. The red areas are the areas of the forest industry. And this narrower line in here along the spring of stream, this would be the maximum area subject to the Oregon Forest for a state of private ownership. But our objective in this exercise is to try to understand the ecological implications of the current ownership pattern. And to do that, we have to understand who owns the land, what's on the land, what their management conditions are, and then to carry these management conditions out in time, where periodically we look into the forest in an analytical sort of way and measure how good it is for various species. And they did mention in this case, for your committee, we're looking at six of the fish, and see if you can. And Tim can certainly describe these, but we're looking at the tuckerel and the chinook and the steelhead and the chub, as well as the clam prey. What other ones did I bring up here? And we have what we call mapping rules that allow us to look at each of these fish along these three segments, and then understand what the habitat conditions would be for them, under the conditions that would exist at that time, and how it would also play out in the future. And then once we know this, not only for the fish, but also a number of the animals that fly and crawl and run, we then ask ourselves, could we organize this landscape in some way that would improve the ecological health for the habitat for each of these fish and animals, while at the same time maintaining the level of timber supply in our public shoreline. If we were to look at this and see a little bit, we might describe these areas a little bit more. If we were to look in very carefully, in this 100,000 acres, we divided this into about 6,000 plots, which means that we are looking at the down at the land spatially at about the 10 to 20 acres up. And then there was a question here about how this model might relate to other models, and the major difference in this model is spatial recognition. In models such as the chairman referred to, M-plan and 4-plan, these are very good models for for representing long-range impacts. If the impacts you're talking about are not related to these other issues, but you could talk about them in broad, strategic terms. But we're going to talk about your very face. Where people own a particular piece of land are spatial, where the roads are spatial, where the streets are spatial, and the relationship between areas that are harvested and areas that are not harvested, those are spatial and have a bearing on the habitat of the earth. So what we're looking at in here, where we're visiting here, we're looking at parcels of land. For example, this one is parcel 4,000 square feet, and it can be recognized on the very vegetation to recognize who owns the land, meaning whether they're industry or the federal agency. We also recognize the land allocation, meaning what is subject to rules of the Oregon Forest Practice Riparian Rules or the Upland Rules, what is subject to the Riparian Reserve Rules or federal agencies or the Lake Protection Reserve or the Matrix. And then when we know this, then that allows us to understand how they were using the land. Within each of these also, we have a representative of the types of species that are there. And what I mean by that is we have a description of the number of species per acre by species, by diameter, by height, and the site productivity of this area, which we need to understand how each tree will project it forward. At the same time, we also have estimates of how many trees out there are standing dead and how many are down on the ground. And as we move these stands forward over time in action and management conditions, we're also keeping track of the trees that leave and also the trees that are dying, the new trees that are being planted, and when trees die and fall, are they likely to go across streams? How large will they be? How much is there to be there? And all of this plays into understanding what these areas will be for fish habitat and wildlife. These, by the way, are also the roads. If you're looking here, the blue are roads. And as we go about the organizing this landscape, we also try to understand how many roads or what kind of transportation system will be needed to carry out the management intentions of land. For every parcel on that landscape, we understand what road is going to be. And certainly a major management concern in the checker board area of this access. And it goes two ways, that both private owners and federal owners can access their other activities. But as activities have changed on the federal land, many of these roads really are no longer needed for federal management for timber production, but they are needed still to provide access to the sector board private land. And a number of the watershed counties are very interested. If there is a way to reorganize the landscape, this road could possibly be delivered. And roads certainly have had a major, certainly many people believe, adversely affect fish habitat. Well, this is a little bit about the production. And I'm going to look at this area in general. And what I'd like to do is try to indicate, before we look at the results, how interconnected the landscape is. If we were, for example, interested in trying to understand what this little parcel is, the habitat food building chip, or the eagle, or the murrelet, or the spotted owl, or the chub, or the cobalt, or anything else. We have to look at much broader than just a small piece. We were talking earlier, perhaps, if you want to understand, if the ground is suitable for animals, go out there and look at it, the size of the trees, the height of the trees, the canopy cover, or maybe shrubs, and look at the trees, the right with your candidate, and you can decide. Thinking has changed from that, and one of the major contributions that this team has made is they have taken the Fish and Wildlife rule and expanded
abandon them so that you're down to a landscape context. For example, if I was to zoom in here and you were to ask, how far we would have to look? How far we would have to look for a small park like such as this one?
Well, I think also not there, but excuse me. No problem.
And if we have something like a three-inch woodpecker, and we were standing right here in this park, we have to evaluate the vegetation condition under all of the other parcels we're looking at around it, not just now, but in the 10 time period forward in our planning horizon. We need to look at the conditions now, and then 10 years from now, and 10 years, and 10 years, to understand how good this area would be for the city of Lubeck. If any owner changes their management intentions, or changes the conditions, such that, whether they change their management intentions and intend to change the ownership pattern, it's going to affect what the city of Lubeck will sell back the next decade and the next decade and afterwards. When we push to the next part, we have to redo that, and so on. You understand here, each one has their own range. If we look at something a little farther, such as the Martin, we would have to look out a couple of miles to give you an idea of the scale. These are about 1 mile. About 1 mile. So if you look at this spot out on the terrain, we would have to look out probably a mile and a half in each direction. If we want to move here, we have to move. How good is this for the Martin? We have to look out another mile and a half. We were just both seeing almost from each other. We would be looking out several miles in each direction to try to understand it. And I think you can understand in the checkerboard pattern where this was green and this was red and this was green and this was red. What all these owners are doing are influencing the habitat's stability of each of these points of landscape. And they're going to influence it differently depending on So, what I want to do here, I might just expand it on to show a little bit about fish, because we've been concentrating on some of the depth ones. I'll come back and bring you back to the map, and we'll look at the fish. And here we have a little tangent scale. This was looking at the margin of the Martin Lake fish, or the fish was concentrated right here. We're looking at about 30 square miles. If we want to look at the fish are a little different. The fish are interlocked across the landscape as well, even though we think they run up and down the creek. So that's where we are focused. We have about 13 or 14 factors that we look at for the fish, and a number of them are constraint factors, and the students will talk about them. And they may have to deal with the shade that's along the stream, the gradient of the stream, how much water is available to fall in the stream, and those affect the fish. But also the fish are affected by how much of the area in the upland is actually covered in trees at any particular point in time. So when we're looking out here in the simulation, searching for patterns, and let's say we want to try to understand the conditions along that stream, that stream down there, we would be having look at all of the uplands around it and the watershed that's draining down here. And what that means is, at each point in time, we're looking to see how everyone's management teams are pointing out and the ages of those trees in the various parts of those watersheds. As well as looking at just how much area is out there, we're also looking at the shade along those various streams and how much water will be in them.
And of course, this is playing out in similarly in these large areas across the entire area. I think we have in this area of 6,000 parcels, we recognize about 2,000 or 3,000 tree stakes.
Well, what are we going to do here? What we're going to try to do here is figure out ecologically, what are the implications of current ownership patterns? And we're not going to go through these numbers, but I want to try to illustrate how it is we think through this pattern. We use habitat feasibility for a large number of creatures to figure out ecological health in the area. This might include the Killingate woodpecker, the acorn woodpecker, the goshawk, the wild owl, the little rat, the eagle, the salamander, the turtle, the frog, the polar, the cockroach, the nose seal, the eggshell, and some that we haven't shown them. And we look at them decade by decade over time, and we try to measure how well these are going. Now you might say, how well these are going compared to what? Well, our benchmark, or what we're trying to focus on, is where in no land exchange the present owner would share their landscape over time. And we can do that. And we can try drawing different patterns ourselves. If you have a minute or two of listening, you might try that. But what we try to do is imagine for a lot of particular species of the material, how would the forest look like if management actually stopped for 100 years? And then that in there and say, how can we get better or not? I mean, and how well did they get? Well, the many experiences we see, that you look back over time, they were there still, and they liked it better than they were there too. We established, if we want the program to search out these white patterns, we established the target conditions for our search as what that forest would have looked like if both the public and the private owners pulled out the trees had grown up, and you looked in there and said, how would they like it? And you just kind of looked at it on the front. And then that was this model, search out and rearrange that landscape such as to get as close to those targets as quickly as you can, but you can't eliminate management. You have to be able to produce the same amount of timber that we did before, both on public lands and private lands, but is there any way to reduce it more efficiently and so we can get as close to our market as we can as quickly as possible. That's where we're going. And I'd like to just indicate here, and we'll just look at one pattern that we do down in a minute or two. But if we were to look at this existing pattern, we divide things into groups and we aggregate it over the landscape. And we have fish and wildlife and watershed and plants. And we want to sum up, this represents how far away we are from our goals. And we don't have time to work on this range for later. But if we could reach our goals, this would be easier out there in terms of minimizing deviation from the sort of green while maintaining the beautiful one. And so with this current landscape, when we projected out this 100 years, owners doing what they would do, each 10 years, we aggregate things up and we say, how close are we to this model for us in our mind? We're in a chance we're not there. This would be zero. And what our goal is, figure out this zero, we need to drive this number to zero, that's what we're about. So, we can see here in the current ownership pattern, we're not there. And I'm going to bring up another one here that we can look at. It's taking a solution that we have run before, it takes a little more time, and it's explaining what the computer thought was a better idea. What they thought was a better idea. And in this case, it rearranged the landscape. It put about 10 square miles up there, and the industry up there in the red. It put this area here into the forest industry, and this area, and so it concentrated activities in blocks. And in this case, the aggregation level is about the watershed. So what we put together is said that no
If we were to bring back this, the number here we were looking at before was about twice this time. And so what this said is, yes, ecological health has improved under this ownership pattern. Okay, now, we have other ownership patterns where we also put ecological health and maintain the supply. This is just an example. It's one where we're testing the methodology in the pilot area. When we come out of these, we understand who ought to we want to own each parcel, just as in the supply can be maintained. We also understand what the impact would be for each fish, for each animal. We understand the evaluation of the animal. We understand how the supply is affected, and also understand which goals are necessary to carry out the plan. Now, this is one way we design this. I'd like to take maybe 10 more seconds of your time for this is by to indicate how we also see this in a collaborative thing. Meaning, this is also a tool to sit down and want to discount the response to Oregon and work out the problem. Because this methodology is transportation. And it's also made in a way to be collaborative. For example, if this is what the computer model was thinking about, a group sitting on a table just like the shell could examine some more alternatives while they're just sitting there in the following way. I could come up here, bring up the menu, and let's say in that industry land, the agency decided, no, there are some parcels that we think are better off in the public domain. What I'm doing is changing red to green, which means those management, essentially, those management intentions are changing. If we want to see what the cumulative effects of our actions are going to be over 100 years, we just run them. We can see the blue cheese that's looking here. And within about 15 or 20 seconds, we will have the social and economic impact of our actions. Okay. If you might recall that previous number that we have here, we started out with about 1.55, we come down to an accuracy measure of 0.7. We extend more land into a more restricted management, a less special reserves, and that has improved ecological health, so it has some very severe impact on timber supply. The timber supply, you get that incremental increase in ecological health, that reduces timber supply on the side of the land by about 10%. But we're not saying what I did with a good trade. We're just saying that is a way, though, that people could then say, okay, now there's some green area, red area, and it's a way for people to sit down at the table who are currently very polarized. Get the information out there and be able to work together to try to find solutions. So we can operate in either way. Right now, we dwell a lot on computer optimization, but also it's made through global learning. So, I'll let that wrap. Sorry, I took a little time.
Senator Ferrioli, you were out of the room and discussed this for a moment, but what was the major difference, I want to make sure it is again, between this and all other models? The first model has been given the ability to go across the landscape, public and private lands. The private landowners have been kind enough to give us all of their dead data, all of their road data, all of their tree data, so that we don't discriminate between the landowners. Instead of just looking at federal land in sort of a linear fashion, we look across everybody's land and spatial. So everything's equal. And we're trying to examine the land.
Can we go back to the closer view of the checkerboard pattern of the
ownership. There's a couple of pages on the map that I thought were extremely interesting.
You mean the draft of the checkerboard?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Question, Representative.
No, go ahead.
Morgan.
Wait for you then.
Okay. Well, I actually will wait until the doctor can get the map back. So if you have a question, go ahead and ask.
Okay. See, I became quite interested in this some time ago and watched a review that took several hours and was really quite astounded by the computer work here and the possibilities that it presented. And where I left the project was just before you sent it out for peer review. And the first thing that I'm curious about is what came back as a result of peer review? What kinds of strengths and what kinds of weaknesses were pointed out to you?
Well, let me try to address that issue. What came back was what I felt was a very objective and very helpful critique. It was generally positive. The scientists that reviewed the project were supportive. I will say, though, in all candor, they had a lot of suggestions for potential changes that we could consider in making the model. And in fact, many of their suggestions we are, in fact, now working to implement. So, by and large, it was a very constructive, very positive experience. And specifically, what came back was a document about this thick, which we'd be happy to provide you with.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Absolutely.
Could you just real basically detail some of the areas that you were given critique on, what the nature of the strengths and the weaknesses that were found?
Sure. Let's take a look at some of the weaknesses, first of all. One of the things that they identified was that, first of all, we should take a harder look at roads. And we recognize that going in. In fact, we have already implemented new procedures to take a closer look at how roads play out in various scenarios. And that meant, first of all, getting a road layer onto the landscape, and then evaluating, being able to look at types of roads, what types of roads might be needed in the future with different types of landscapes, and what types of roads might not be needed. So roads was a major area of emphasis. There was also, I thought, very good advice to us that we should take a harder look at what we call sensitivity analysis. And that simply means testing things to extremes, if you will. If you change some things, how does the model react? Does it react realistically? And we are now in the process of doing that. In fact, we've hired a systems analyst to help us do that. So that's really helped us better understand how all of these things work together. And I think you have seen this, and obviously you've seen it before. You can appreciate the sensitivity of it and the complexity of it is tremendous. And there were some other recommendations made specifically in terms of the configuration of LSRs on federal land, because when that was done in the Northwest Forest Plan, it was done specifically to create a regional network of reserves. And there is some concern on some of the part of the review and science of how this might change that. And we collaboratively, working with some of the federal agencies, I think have now tentatively identified some different scenarios to examine that would address that issue specifically. Now, on the positive side, what they saw was something that they'd never seen before, and they were amazed at what had been done in 4 years. They saw it as cutting-edge technology, and they saw it as innovative, and they saw it as something that could be immensely useful, probably beyond the realm of landing as well. And I think it's the integrated nature of this project, looking at multiple resources through time across the nation.
May I have one more question?
Absolutely.
Another place where I think there were a lot of questions and not very many answers when I left this the last time had to do with how the ONC funds distribution and the Forest Service funds distribution was going to be worked out during the land exchange process. And I was just curious about where that discussion had gone and if there had been anything resolved about that.
Yes. We have a sort of a memorandum of understanding between the Umpqua Land Exchange Project and the Oregon Association of ONC Towns. So that, as John described earlier, a constraint in the model is that there cannot be a reduction in the federal land base, nor can any run reduce the amount of harvestable timber on federal nature plants. So that everything that we do is constrained by that being necessary. And as we move forward into the larger basin, that will continue to be the case. that the federal land base stays static no matter what kind of exchanges occur, or relative to static. And if the amount of harvestable timber as is allowed by the Northwest Forest Plan, which in this little area was about 59 million board feet per decade, still has to be eligible. You still have to have that much land eligible to harvest on the timberland, on the federal land, whatever the federal allocation of timber harvest is.
And are you applying that same concept to the Forest Service lands?
The Forest Service lands. We're not, I guess the most straightforward answer to that question is, at least in this next phase, we don't see the Forest Service lands as being in the trade pool. It's the Saipan National Forest, and there's down to almost no harvest there at all. So I don't know that I can say that that's an absolute fact.
Well, we were
curious
about the management and retention of the federal forest managers, and they improved them with the Northwest Forest Plan. And if I recall better, as Mark Elliott has, under their new intention, has come down
Can I jump one more time?
Okay.
I guess my next question is kind of a philosophical one. I'm assuming that you're also pursuing discussions along with the counties and the industrial timberland owners with the government agencies that are involved in here. What are you hearing from the BLM in terms of their willingness to become involved in this program?
I can answer that question a lot more comfortably today than I could have 7 days ago. Let's start with the state agencies, maybe. I think with the state agencies, we've had absolutely terrific cooperation. The Elliott State Forest is in this next piece, or trunk of the Elliott State Forest is in this next piece of the project, and the ODF has been superb about not just sharing information, but sitting down along and talking with us about how we're going to do this, as has the EQ, because the Smith River Basin is in this next phase, which needs a TMDL plan by December 31st, and we have met with they and the EPA now 3 times about what we might be able to do with our shade rule that could help them. We're not going to build a TMDL plan, but we are willing, if it's within the context of improving the model anyway, to do what we can to help. And they've been great with this. As has ODF and W, all the effective stream overlays we're using now have their salmon overlays on top of them, and we're going to get back to them for ODF and W to use. At the federal level, we've had numerous conversations and ongoing participation with Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA and National Marine Fisheries Service, as well as BLM and Forest Service. This model is really cutting edge, and I think that the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, we have probably been learning a lot about or communicating with them in terms of what the cumulative impacts of this kind of a model are. We have reached a point where we're down to a couple of not insignificant but solvable issues that we'll be meeting with the Forest Service and the BLM on July 20th.
What are the nature of those issues?
There's this regional LFR issue still needs to be stamped out and really understood how that's going to be handled. So the Northwest Forest Plan is built around that whole regional network. And I think we still need to resolve the thing that that's going to be done. And secondly, the BLM would like a little more explanation from us on if they're going to have these land exchanges occur and probably more sensitive land transfer into their ownership. Well, more sensitive lands would, whether it's deep and low growth, as an example. How are they still going to be able to maintain their timber supply responsibilities? How are we going to get that done? I'd say those two issues are probably real high on the list for the July 20th meeting. Pending that, we have received a letter from the BLM Director Tom Fry yesterday expressing encouragement and their desire to work with us in a collaborative manner to move forward on the project.
I would be curious to know in a very broad sense, the direction that the project is going to go in from here. Are you moving it into an implementation phase?
Yes. Implementation in this sense. we have completed a pilot study and done peer review. So we have left sort of the theoretical world. Practical means that we are going to focus very hard on finishing the science in the 675,000 acres. That is accurately mapping it, and then by roughly April of next year, being able to show some coarse grain land exchange possibilities, as you just saw today. And then at that point, the product would become an analysis tool for a NEPA process, in which willing owners would come to the table, and the model would be used to help analyze the ecological impacts and the timber supply impacts of various scenarios.
How is this going to be paid for when you actually get to the land exchange part of it?
Well, I don't think I should back up for a minute. What we've agreed with the federal land managers is we'll focus on the science and getting it done and won't try and stray off into land exchanges yet. So I want to make it clear this project has three phases: the pilot study, finishing the science, and then examining the land exchanges. But our assumption is that when you move the land exchanges, it's like they are always paid for. The private owners have to incur all of their costs, and the public land managers incur their costs. The project would not be involved in paying for land exchanges. It would be involved in paying for the tools to help the analysis. Now, what we're hoping to do is if moving the land exchanges is a good idea, and if the NEPA process is started to get that rolling, if this is an analysis tool, will assist that process in giving it better data to understand the implications of what it's doing and should help reduce the costs.
Okay.
Okay, Jeff.
How are you able in your modeling to selectively choose your land exchanges?
Yes.
And in the selective choice of your land exchanges, are you able to then identify the better options, better choices for exchanges?
Well, that's the collaborative feature that John was referring to. I think that's when you get down to willing owner and willing owner. And what we're trying to do with this model is take the mystery out of the land exchange process for the general public, so that as the process moves into a NEPA evaluation, that people like anybody here could sit around and be involved in taking a look at that landscape. They're completely capable of examining any specific parcel of land and changing its color and telling you what would happen.
One additional item. Are there any attempts being made to, and is it possible to look at changes or adaptability of, of species in the area as to how that may or may not affect your modeling?
Which species? I'm sorry.
Any of, I mean, since all of the species are potentially available for our purposes of listing. I mean,
well, I think the team, and I'll answer this broadly, that they've been through this conversation quite a few times, and it was actually some in peer review about what ecological health meant.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the goal right now is to essentially stick to the rare, threatened, and endangered species list. There's some indicator species, I'll stop at that, but do not try and mock every single species.
Okay. In relationship to the threatened or endangered species, have we been able to look at any modeling of changes, adaptability of that species to different environments this year? Is that making sense?
I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about. Are you modeling how a species might adapt to a new environment?
Yes.
I think
okay. So basically, we're holding species constant. Okay.
I have a question again about the I think is implied from the map. Can you go to a little closer scale so that we can see the differences between
parcel, especially the riparian buffer, at perfect scale. That is very typical of the pattern of Western Oregon lands, where every other section owned by the federal agency is Bureau of Land Management and or Forest Service. That is a very common pattern in Western Oregon. But as you know, BLM, there's an anomaly in the Bureau of Land Management that has forest land. They are primarily a rangeland management. But I can see adaptability for this model anywhere in Oregon, since we have federal land managers across the landscape, and there are interspersements of land ownership, regardless of where you're going. Whether or not this is a checkerboard, which makes the corners is very obvious, or a different form of interspersement, they are still intermingled. What strikes me about this map is when you look at the private lands, which I assume are red on this map, you see that the Oregon Forest Practices Act buffers are markedly different from those on the federal forest land. And the federal forest land buffers, I guess they would be prescribed by the terrain more than any particular restrictions like we see in the Forest Practices Act. But as we've learned in the watershed studies that we've done, getting a comprehensive management for temperature standards, for instance, is very difficult when you have buffer cycles changing and management that are changing. And so I can see the implication for watershed health. We also know that there's been a lot of discussion about squaring up or plotted increments so that management costs are reduced and that management practices can be more consistent over a larger land. So I can see how that would be something that would be facilitated by these exchanges. One of the things that's really been difficult for us to deal with in the rural communities on the east side of the state is that on the East Side Ecosystem Management Project, we have very poor or non-existent socioeconomic data and analysis. Either it's added as an afterthought or it just doesn't exist. This seems to me to be an opportunity to get that socioeconomic analysis done at the front of the project so that you can make different choices based on all the implications, not just financial resource implications. So I think that is an excellent opportunity. And in all the existing models that I know, changing the parameters invalidates the run. You have to start over again and do another run. And it's extremely expensive and very cumbersome. And so you spend a whole lot of money trying to get four or five alternatives in the NEPA process. And then if there are change in those alternatives, it's fabulously expensive to add or subtract an alternative after the project's already modeled. So this seems to me really to be a one-touch, kind of a button, point-and-shoot change. And I'd really be interested to see how this compares with the modeling that we see coming out of the Forest Service and the BLM for their planning. In other words, the cost comparison and the feature-by-feature comparison to see what it is that this model can do that produces the same kind of a product, and then the cost of this. We're working with the federal agencies to try to get modeling contracted out of the agency. And so the mechanism to do that, perhaps we could speed up some of the NEPA processes that now take a year to 2 years for an EIS, an environmental impact statement, when we should be able to do it in an hour of hours if we have the variables in the modeling that we're doing. One question occurs to me is, could this same effect be achieved without a land-based transfer? In other words, could you make the model work with intergovernmental agreements that use stewardship contracts, for instance, and change the management regime on a parcel in addition to actually changing the ownership? They're also working with stewardship contracts with federal agencies, and they're starting to get more aggressive about it.
That could be done.
Okay. I think that's great implications. You're aware that we are working in the state of Oregon on a state of the environment project and in connection with the Oregon benchmarks. Have you interfaced at all with the Oregon Benchmark folks? Because I think this has great implications for them. They're trying to get a snapshot of the environment, and they're also trying to do some projections. If you haven't connected with those folks, I think they'd be very interested. In our subcommittee, we were looking at trying to get benchmarks established for natural resource agencies, but there are no good mechanisms for projections. So, you know, we can describe in round, glowing terms where we'd like to be, but there really isn't any mechanism to show how we're supposed to get there. And this model seems to me to show how we could get there. And I'd like to make that reference if you, after the meeting. I'd like to connect you with the Oregon Benchmark. The only other question that occurs to me is that you seem to be coming at this from a land base, looking at the features of the land, and then also trying to look at the desired future conditions, either the private landowner or the federal agency. What I'm seeing and what others are seeing in the federal land management is we get the answer and then we ask the question. And that's why you have a 5 million board foot output on a forest that has an ASQ or a biological potential of 3 million board too. It doesn't have a doggone thing to do with the management regime. It has to do with the political decision made by the administration. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think the premise of this project, Senator, members of the committee, is that you start with the science first, and you start with a very open process developed for science and models and mapping rules that, while complicated, can also be understood. And then you move to a conversation about what you might want to do with the land, but only after you've done science work first. In terms of the national forest, whether it's the Cayuse Forest and Umpqua, or the matrix plans that the ONC would harvest off of, I don't think we can answer that question, Senator. But I think we do believe that if you don't do a cumulative effect, cumulative in the sense of whatever your model affects on the land before you start to try and mess with it, because of the quality of data that's available now, it's moving as fast as all other computerized data in forestry and watersheds, that it's probably not going to be very easy to justify what you do with that data.
Final question, is there a product that you would like to see from this committee? There are many letters of recommendation supporting the committee. Is there some action that you would like the committee to take?
Well, there's one or perhaps two. The first is, because this committee has no, it goes on in perpetuity at this point, that we would be very interested in what...
As a matter of fact, my members have said that this meeting is going on.
Excuse me, Senator Shields, I apologize. You asked the toughest question of all, just a minute ago. I think it's you.
This is the best you've looked all session
I've ever. This tells you how well I know the legislature. I apologize.
There will be no more outbursts from the audience, please.
I might as well just control all of the comments on that, huh?
Colleagues, we're at the point of asking the committee or the panel, what product would you like to see out of this
committee? We'd really like to see this committee take a look at whether or not this is a product they formally endorse. We think as a landscape-based analysis tool, without land, even if you take land exchanges out of the mix, it offers the best hope that we've ever seen in Oregon, and I would offer in North America, for people to solve very complex decisions in a way so nobody's afraid that something's happening apart under the table that they can't see. And we think it's the kind of product that it both deserves and deserves support. And I'd offer that for the first time, maybe in a long time, you have a group of scientists who have really stepped up to the plate and are moving past theory, and are willing to have their work actually examined as something that would be applied to real-life situations. And I think that's a fairly unique and admirable thing.
Richard Morgan?
I apologize. In closing, Mr. Chair, this is a project that I think a lot of people, especially a lot of people in Douglas County, have a very interested eye on, and I think that
the computer work and the science-based nature of the project is extremely commendable, and it really does put a different slant on the whole discussion about what's best for the land, and it gives it a kind of a science-based objectivity that wasn't there before. And I think that to nurture this project and to ensure that it does go forward, and I think none of us at this point are real sure where it's going to end up. That's what I'm getting from you, is that the goalposts are out there in the fog someplace still. But this is so much more productive than sitting around the table saying, I'm right, you're right, that I think that we're really onto something, and I commend what you're doing here and just encourage you to go ahead with it.
Would you want to see that encouragement put in writing for the committee signature?
I would be very pleased to see that.
I think enough of the membership, enough of the presentation, that we could draft such a letter, and we could circulate it among the members and see if there's any objections to having such a letter go forward. I tend to think that they would support any mechanism that makes clear what the implications of management decisions would be.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd support that. I was involved in this project way back before the project got smarter than I am. So, and from the genesis of this was from one person basically, but it was quickly bought into, and it's amazing the amount of people who have been involved in this. It truly is. So I think this is a good innovative way to look at doing things.
I'm going to charge the members that are familiar with this project with educating your colleagues when we get that letter available.
We're not that smart.
Any other questions to come before the panel?
We can take it.
I did leave 4 copies of the peer review and the study up here, so if anyone has an interest to do that.
Question, Jensen?
Is there any possibility that Karen Jensen is there any possibility that during the interim these folks can come back to us and maybe a half a day or a full day kind of workshop on this? I think there's a lot more here that I would like to know about, and a lot of questions that I have this time, and also my knowledge and understanding does not allow.
Mr. Kelly, do you think the good doctors could be prevailed upon to come back for an interim presentation?
I think so. And there are people like Dr. Dutcher with watersheds and Dr. Stan Gregory and fisheries who I think would really, really enjoy that opportunity, because that would give us a chance to really look at some real more specific issues.
Thank you. Then we will make that invitation. Is there any other business to come before the committee besides the announcement that the independent multidisciplinary science team will be meeting July 14th, and the 15th. So if any of the members would like to attend those meetings, those are available. Any other business to come before the committee? Hearing none, Senator Shields moves adjournment. Is there any questions on that? Hearing none, Chair adjourned.
Yeah.